plain as Gough, if not more so. And just trying to think of a couple of. It was interesting. It was said that Keating was the great numbers man in New South Wales, and that the New South Wales right would follow him on anything, particularly the leadership. And it was said that if Keating ever sided with Hawke against Hayden, Hayden would get rolled for the leadership. According to Hayden, and I believe it to be true, Keating was the last person from the New South Wales right to shift his support from Hayden to Hawke. Hayden was of the view, again I believe probably correctly, that Keating did not have the same clout within the New South Wales party as he liked people to believe. Grant Richardson, on the other hand, for the time, he was a significant political figure, did have quite a lot of influence within the New South Wales right wing of the party. And nevertheless, he was quite a character, Graham. I used to spend a reasonable amount of time with them in Sydney at Labor Party conferences. The New South Wales conference was in the 70s and 80s and before. Was a very, very significant political event, as was the Victorian one, because they, in those days, the conferences really did determine Labor Party policy, whereas today they tend to be a lot more, or a lot less influential in terms of parliamentary party policy, although they may still be able to exert a lot of influence on who becomes the leader of the party. But the conference itself tends to be a little bit more for show than anything. But these ones, were, in the old days, they were quite significant, and both Keating and Richardson would find, and I found it mutually constructive to be able to just have a discussion about various issues and things that the party was going on, I vividly recall one. Conference Labor had in Victoria where the motion was put that they should adopt affirmative action for Paul didn't take me aside, he just was standing beside me, and he was giving these stupid so-and-so men and these something or other women the rounds of the kitchen verbally, not to them, but to me, and saying what a stupid idea it was, it was over his dead body that he'd ever see quotas given for people to get into the party and or get into Parliament. And not very long after that, his public position was that he was totally in favour of affirmative action and it should have happened long ago. So, I mean, just goes to show what politicians say in private and what they think in private is not necessarily consistent when they're in a position where they've got to say something in public.
Mm-hmm.
I also vividly recall one day in the New South Wales Town Hall where it was the June Labor Conference, annual state Labor Conference, and someone was putting up a motion from the floor that was, in effect, reinforcing Labor's socialist platform. And Paul was standing beside me and he said, "Look at all these silly so-and-so's. He said, "The problem is they're all locked into the warm inner glow of futility, and they'll put these stupid ratbag motions up so that they feel good and stop us getting into power." And He also made no bones about expressing strong views about people, personalities, and events.
He was a no-nonsense kind of politician.
No, not at all. But he certainly had a great turn of phrase. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And, he could shred an opponent just with words. So he was.
There's that idea about him that he was quite debonair and sophisticated and charming. Mm. He could be does that tally with your experience?
Oh, yes, he could be. And he loved his antique clocks, and he genuinely did. I think he was not unique. I think he was... like so many of us, I suppose, of people who started off on the what might be termed the wrong side of the tracks, or the more difficult part of society, and took advantage of every opportunity that came their way, and then decided that the lifestyle of that they'd been denied as children was well worth pursuing, as they got to a position where they could. And I think his interest in arts, culture, and other things is quite genuine. And and as you said, he could be an extremely charming dinner companion or social companion, within seconds could cut you to ribbons.
Yeah, it's strange how people at the time criticised him. It's as though. Being from Bankstown means you're not allowed or not supposed to be cultured and like classical music, or you know, you're meant to be
a Bergen or whatever.
I'd like to move on and ask about your role as a lobbyist. Let me know if you want a break at this reason. If it's okay with you to move on, is there anything else you want to say?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So with the lobbying, it was the Australian Health Insurance Association, and it came about, I believe, after you left the gallery in 83.
Yeah, well, I was in the... what happened, actually, was that after the 83 election, I was pretty well worn out, to put it mildly, from because I had been travelling a hell of a lot, and I was seriously thinking about whether I wanted to stay in journalism in perpetuity or not. There were opportunities. I would almost certainly have moved up to Sydney and been made a deputy editor, or ultimately editor, and probably worked my way through the ranks from there. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to do that. I wasn't enthusiastic about leaving Canberra. During the year, I had been invited to speak at the Private Hospitals Conference in Sydney. So I didn't know much about hospitals in those days, but I knew what I liked. And I went up there, and I had always had an interest in health policy, and so I went up there and I proceeded to tell them that one of the reasons that governments interfered so much with health policy was because the hospital sector had never really made itself had never been well regarded politically or by the community. Particularly in the private hospital arena. And a guy came over to me and introduced himself and said that was one of the best speeches he'd ever heard, which amazed me because I didn't really think I knew all that much about the subject. And it turned out that he was, at that stage, the president of what was called the Voluntary Health Insurance Association of Australia. And he said that they would be looking for a new executive director, and would I be interested in the job? And I said, I don't really know. I'll think about it. And a little while later, I was approached by the headhunting firm that they'd appointed and invited to put my name forward. So I did. And I, again, didn't think a lot about it. Hawke went on his first overseas trip, so I went on that with him and came back again pretty well physically exhausted, physically and mentally exhausted. And waiting for me on the first day back was a call from the headhunter asking me if I'd go and meet the interviewing panel for the job of executive director, as it was then called, of the Voluntary Health Insurance Association, which represented all the private health funds. And I went to that interview and I proceeded again, because at that stage Medicare was on the horizon. It hadn't actually been introduced. The legislation was being prepared and the health insurance industry was aware that it was going to be very severely, adversely affected by the introduction of the new system.
So what year are we
This was 1983.
Medicare hadn't?
No, it hadn't. It came in the 1st of February 1984. And it was actually what had been termed the Hayden Health Plan, which was an extension of the original Medibank Mark I that Whitlam had introduced. And I effectively, again, probably insulted the people on the interviewing panel by telling them that I thought they had not done a particularly good job representing themselves or their industry over the years, and that the private sector had to get its act together if it was going to have any influence with government. And I walked out thinking I've blown that one, and 24 hours later I was asked how soon I could start. And I was ambivalent even then, but I finally thought, well, yeah, this might be an interesting thing to do for a year or so and give me some a gap year sort of thing. And so I took the job on. I started in September. I can't remember the exact date. I do recall, I think it was the 15th, it was the day that the Medicare legislation was going through the Parliament. And that was rather a relief because I was so new in the job, I couldn't I couldn't be expected to stop it, amend it, or anything like that. So we had to learn to live with it. Neil Blewett had been given... Neil always wanted foreign affairs, but he'd been given the job of shadow health spokesman, and he had to put together the... he became health minister and he had to put together the enabling legislation. And he was a very, very shrewd person. He would have been a great poker player, as a number of people said. He never let you really know exactly what he was planning or what he was doing. And he was very, very good at bluffmanship or brinkmanship. And and so the legislation went through. Interestingly, the government had claimed that when Medicare was introduced, no one would have to pay more than $5 per week for their private health insurance. And that just wasn't true. Even Medibank Private, was government owned and had outmaneuvered the private industry all the way through. And Medibank Private staked a claim to be the sole administering agency for the new health scheme, meaning the health insurance industry just lost all their business and all their transaction capacity with medical claims, which is where they could make they could use the cash flow to remain profitable. They had a searing experience a few years earlier when Malcolm Fraser was Prime Minister. Fraser was going into an election in 1977, and he was concerned about the price of health insurance, so he refused to allow the insurers to increase their premiums. And at that time, well, the biggest health fund in Australia, MBF, got to within 2 days of running out of money. It was almost bankrupt. after the election, Fraser allowed the prices to rise, and of course, having held them down for so long, they were even bigger than before, and that caused a major problem for both the government and the image of health insurance generally, and was one of the reasons why Medicare became popular. Anyway, Medibank Private was not able to meet its reserve requirements and also offer premiums at $5 a week for families. And so a bargaining process commenced between me, who was only in the job for about 2 or 3 months, didn't know a lot about the industry, and the Department of Health and another official who was quite instrumental in the introduction of Medicare, as to what the rates should be in each state. And it was went on the lines of, well, if Medibank went to $6, how close could your people come to $6? Because we want the rates to be as low as they'll go, but Medibank won't go beyond $6.50. Can you come down to $6.50? So I'd get on the phone to my people and say, look, in your state, Medibank will be offering its product at $6.50. Can you get it down to that? Oh, we'll make it $6.80, or we'll make it $6.50 or $7 or whatever it might be. The ACCC today would be mortified if that sort of behaviour took place, and it doesn't. In fact, one of the things that I take some pride in being party to is creating an extremely competitive position between the insurers, which forces them to minimise rate increases, although many people would not believe that's the case. But it is true, it's a very, very competitive market. I can explain why later. So that was the beginning of the job. I decided that there was no point having a long drawn out battle with the government over Medicare. They had the numbers, they had the capacity to control it all. So I made sure that we developed, or maintained, because the industry had developed a rapport with Blewett, but I made sure that we maintained and improved that relationship. So we'd go out and have dinner with Blewett and senior officers of the department every couple of months, where our problems could be shared with the government and the government could share their intentions and some of their problems with us. And it became a very, very effective working relationship. At the same time, Blewett followed his own agenda. But there was one thing I'd learned, a couple of things I learned. Firstly, most policy is set by the bureaucracy, not by politicians, with the exception of the real big bang electoral policy stuff. And even then, once the bureaucracy gets its hands on it, it will tend to mould the proposal in its own, what it sees as being its own image. But that if you could create sufficient political circumstances, you could have a minister make a decision which would force the department to not accept that the minister had decided something, and that was that, even though it might run contrary to their long-term agenda. Knowing full well, of course, that when ministers changed, they could revert to their long-term agenda. On one occasion, we had a particular problem within the industry in that the price of cover for the older funds was going through the roof. And we set up a task force to find out why that was so. And believe it or not, the industry had virtually no statistical information at all in those days. And I'd learned that the only way you were going to influence the bureaucracy was to present them with unchallengeable facts and data. So we set up a task force to just look at the age makeup of the insurance industry. And without it being too surprising, discovered that the longer established organisations all had a very ageing membership. People, about 10% of their members were over 65, but they represented 40% of the claims. So if you had a significant number of older people within the fund, you would become uncompetitive in the marketplace, and that became a vicious cycle where you became more and more uncompetitive. And there are a couple of solutions to that problem, one of which was to make everyone share in the risk of the high end users, the high cost people who are basically people over 65. And another was to limit the capacity of new insurance organisations, which had come out of the woodwork when Medicare was introduced, to limit their capacity to recruit younger members from the older funds, while putting up barriers such as waiting periods for people who were sick who were transferring into the new fund. So if you had a pre-existing ailment, you couldn't transfer. And we put to Blewett on a number of occasions the need to change this. And the department was obstinate and bitterly opposed to any change. So I decided one day that we had to get a very solid message to the government about this. And we printed a little pamphlet, and which said that old people are soon going to be uninsured because of the refusal of the minister and the prime minister to protect them, and went on and on. And we letterboxed Neil Blewett's street, where he lived, his residential street, and his electoral office, so the street in which his electoral office was. So we only produced, I think, about 100 or 200 pamphlets. On the Saturday, Blewett rang my then president, Bill Cousins, who's now deceased, and said, "I've just wondering, Bill, what are you proposing to do with these pamphlets?" And Bill said, "Oh, we're going to distribute them all over the place, Neil." Neil said, "How many have you printed?" Bill said, "Oh, we've got about a million at the moment, and we'll have 6 million by the time we're finished." Neil said, "Do you think you could ask that Schneider fellow to stop the press? And perhaps you could come to my office on Monday morning and we'll talk about this." So we went to the office on the Monday morning and we talked about it, and we received an undertaking from Blewett that after the election he would act. Now, similarly, it was an earlier election, I think. We did a similar thing, not quite the same, but Peter Beattie, who was Premier of Queensland, had been the Labor Party, or was the Labor Party State Secretary at the time. And again, I rang Peter and said, "Look, we have got a very real problem about the way the legislation is acting contrary to the interests of the elderly population. And if nothing is done, we will have to make a very, very strong political, public campaign out of it." And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to..." He said, "I can't do anything before the election." And I said, "Well, yeah, I know, but I'd like to... if I can get a question asked at a press conference, and the Prime Minister gives a commitment that he will take action to do this, that'll be fine." And Peter said, "Leave it with me." And he rang me back a little while later and said, "You organise for that question." And I got onto a friend in the gallery who asked the question, and Hawke gave the commitment that we wanted. And after the election, I took it to the department and said, "The Prime Minister's committed to doing this." And the officer said, "I wasn't there when he made that commitment." So, fortunately, Hawke did pass the word that he did expect his commitment to be undertaken, and so we got another small passage of legislation through the Parliament. There were a number of little incidents like that, but it was basically a case of understanding what drove the people in power, what they could tolerate and what they couldn't tolerate. And there were some things that were just non-negotiable, and there was no way in the world, no matter how much the industry might have wanted to see things done, there was no way in the world that a government could do it. They had... Medicare was really the price the community and the government paid for being able to sell the Commonwealth Bank, TAA, Qantas, all those things. Well, not Qantas, but TAA. And they wouldn't have been able to denationalise those things if they weren't able to provide the unions and the Labor Party generally with the promise of universal healthcare. So there was never any point in trying to go down that path. But we were able, in a number of areas where it was quite clearly disadvantageous to a significant section of society, where the legislation could be tweaked to change things, and so we were able to do that. And I found actually working with the Labor Party was quite constructive. Funnily enough, on a number of those issues, the coalition opposed some of the propositions that we had fought very hard to get the government to agree to. And so that was that. When the Howard government came in, things changed quite a bit. Of course, there was one little story. When Keating became Prime Minister and Graham Richardson became Health Minister, Richardson asked me to bring my executive or board to a meeting with him. And so my board sat there and decided that they'd come up with this great presentation about all the things that needed to be done in the industry, ta-ra, ta-ra. And Richardson came to the office, came to the meeting late. He'd been up all night watching cricket, he said. They proceeded to introduce themselves. He said, "Don't worry about that, I won't remember who you are." He said, "We've got a presentation for you." He said, "I don't want to see that." He said, "I just called you in here to tell you that there's going to be a fight with the doctors." And everyone said, "Oh, that's good," because the health insurers and the AMA had been at loggerheads for years. And Richardson said, "Yeah, there's going to be a fight with the doctors, but I'm not going to fight with the doctors. You're going to fight with the doctors." And we said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you've convinced me that one of your big problems is the price that the doctors are charging their customers, and that's leading to a lot of out-of-pocket costs and big gaps. And we're going to fix that because we're going to allow you to come into contract with the hospitals and the doctors to limit their prices. And that's going to cause a real war. And I'm going to sit back and watch it." And then he got up and walked out the room. So we were sort of delighted because we'd been pushing for this for some time. But they were really nonplussed at the forcefulness with which he told us what we're going to do. And as it turned out, we did end up with legislation going through. Richardson had departed, and his successor, Carmen Lawrence, oversaw the introduction of legislation which allowed funds to contract with doctors and hospitals, which has worked out moderately well, not as well as it might have, but moderately so. Then, of course, the Howard government came in, and they were very, very... their first health minister was Michael Woolridge, and Michael was, in my view, the best health minister that the country's ever had. He was seriously concerned. He was a doctor. He understood the politics of the industry. He understood the workings of the public and private sectors. He was determined to... he convinced John Howard that Medicare should remain. The past many years in which successive Liberal oppositions had threatened to dismantle Medicare was gone. Michael was his most significant achievement, in my view, was always that he got immunisation rates up from very, very low levels up to around about 90%. Then, of course, they declined again after he left. Under his ministership and John Howard, a number of concessions were provided which made the private health insurance system much more freely available, and we got the insured population up from 30% to 50% with a combination of different measures, many of which originated from the industry or from my office. We put forward the idea of the Medicare levy surcharge, and which is one of the great ways of stimulating high income earners to be insured. We worked very closely with the government on the 30% rebate, and later a higher rebate for older people, and things like that. So it was a pretty satisfactory experience, actually, all those years.
Yeah. How long were you in that role?
I was there for 22 years, and I just couldn't leave it.
Yeah, so that first, where you thought, oh, I might do it for a year, to, like a gap year,
yeah.
Certainly.
News Limited didn't invite me back. At one stage, Laurie Oakes had left Channel 10, and they wanted to rejig things, and they offered me a job as sort of News Limited Supremo, running the television operation, Channel 10 operation in Canberra, and the News Limited Bureau in Canberra. And I thought about that very seriously. I was very, very tempted. Finally, I decided that I'd only been with the insurers for about 6 to 12 months, and I felt I'd be dumping them in the lurch if I left, so I stayed with them and stayed there for 22 years.
Sounds like you were very effective.
Well, it would be immodest to say so, but I think other people would probably say yes, that was the case. We did achieve quite a lot, mostly by identifying problems and solutions for government which were politically acceptable. Mm-hmm. There's no point in proposing a solution to a government if it's going to cause a political pain, unless the problem is greater than the pain that the solution will cause. Right.
You mentioned, you know, that you met with Neil Blewett and others. Was this building part of those meetings? Would you actually come here physically to meet with them?
Yes. This access to this building was much easier than it is to the new building, or even was to the new building. You still needed a pass to get round, but it was pretty easy to get a pass as an industry representative or a lobbyist, whichever you wanted to call it. So you could just walk through the door and virtually wander into the minister's office, and if you picked the right time of day, you had a reasonable chance of the minister walking in or out of the office, and if they weren't doing anything, be invited to go into the office and sit down and what's your problem. Other times it'd be more formal. There were times when one would have to make an appointment, and usually that would end up with either the permanent head of the department or a senior officer coming along to be with the minister, so that they knew what was being talked about, they knew what the minister was seeking, and to some extent keeping the minister under control, making sure he didn't make promises that they didn't want to keep. So that was a fairly regular part of it. And of course, you wouldn't just confine your visit to the minister or his staff. You'd see the shadow minister and various other people who had an interest in health policy, or who were just friends, mates. You'd go into the press gallery and have a yarn to people up there about what was going on. Maybe decide to go over to the lobby for lunch or whatever. I'd come over to Parliament House probably once, maybe even twice a week when the Parliament was sitting. When it's not sitting, I found it easier when they weren't sitting to go into state and see the minister or the MP in their own electorate, because the one problem, and it's still the case, of trying to see members of Parliament when Parliament is sitting is that the bells are always ringing, and they're constantly getting called into the chamber, or Cabinet might have a sudden meeting, or a backbench committee might suddenly need to have a minister come and explore. Might need the members or the minister to come in there, so you have no certainty about any capacity to have a serious discussion with anyone.
How was the new building? How did that affect the ability and the effectiveness of being a lobbyist?
It wore out a lot more shoe leather. It's so much bigger, so you certainly. the capacity to just bump into someone in the corridors is became extremely limited. Access itself wasn't so hard because the pass still allowed one to wander in, enter, and once you're inside the building, you could go anywhere you liked. You could even park down in the private car parks or the employee car parks underneath the hill. But whereas you could walk around this building in an hour and probably see the four or five most important, or on the occasion, for the purpose, the four or five most important people you needed to see, you couldn't do that in a day in the new building because it's just so enormous. The chances of bumping into someone in the corridor are very remote. Their offices usually are so big and palatial that they can sit in there themselves and watch what's going on in the chamber on a big flat screen TV. So it takes more time. But having said that, the architects did a remarkably good job of making it. For one who knew their way around this building, it's very easy to find your way around the new one. The logic of it is much the same, even though the actual corridors might be different and rooms are different, but there's still a sort of a feel, a vibe that lets you go from one place to another.